from the vault. High atop the pastoral center of the Diocese of Camden, you're listening to Talking Catholic.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Talking Catholic. I'm Jen Morrow, and with me today is Mike Walsh.
Did you like that?
It was very NPR-ish this morning.
It was. I'm starting to think that you're actually doing that to antagonize our Vicar General, who likes to make fun of us about this, some of the NPR openings.
Oh, no. That was just because it's early, and I've had only half a cup of coffee, so I'm not jazzed up yet.
No, it is early.
I'm jazzed about our guests, but I'm not jazzed for normal banter.
Yeah, this may be the earliest podcast we've ever done in the history of the 373 episodes that we've done of this podcast. We rolled in before 10 a.m. down in Atlantic City, so we had our nice little hour-long drive to come down here. But I love coming down here. I actually enjoy an hour-long drive. The hard part was getting out of my car and then knowing I had to speak to people. that was the tricky part.
That does not apply to the guests. Let me just say that right now.
No, just humanity. It has nothing to do with our guests. We may have mentioned this in recent podcasts, is that one of the goals this year is for you and I to get out of the office more often. So this was a great opportunity to actually make it happen.
And I was excited to drive down to Atlantic City because I have a lot of memories here because my parents lived here for over 20 years, right down the street. Parish of St. Monica was their parish. And so I pulled up and said, "Ooh, I'm going to this bakery when I leave to go get some rainbow cookies, and maybe I should call the office to see if they want a White House sub." And I'm planning all my eating places.
Wait a second. We have another podcast to record after this on the other side of the state.
I know, but I am going around the corner to get the cookies because it's three doors down. Yeah.
Formica?
Formica.
Okay. Yeah. We can give a shout out to the local businesses.
Formica's Bakery, where you ever want the rainbow cookies, the best rainbow cookies in the state. I don't know what the real world for those little square guys with the colors inside.
So wait. You're talking about the Italian cookies that I made last year and you said how great they were?
Yeah, but I'm sorry. They're not Formica's. Formica's are the best.
Okay.
There's a moment of silence.
I don't know if I agree with any of this. I don't enjoy having my baking considered anything other than top notch.
No,
but all right, whatever.
That's
okay. Whatever. I'm not offended. That's all right.
Do you want me to buy you one afterward? Do you want to try it?
No.
You want to have a rainbow cookie off?
You know what the irony is? Mm. So I made those cookies because you requested them last year.
And I loved them. They were good.
Yeah, I don't like them.
Oh. Oh, really?
The almond is overpowering in the taste. So it's too much for me.
Almond, marzipan, all that. Just the more the merrier.
Yeah. Well, enjoy. I hope you enjoy them because I will never make them again. So you definitely need to go to Formica. So we're down here and we're enjoying it. And I'm very excited about it. And this is the second time I get to interview our two guests in the span of a week because we've been doing quite a bit of coverage of their winter shelter down here in Atlantic City. Bishop Sullivan was down here. For our avid readers of the Catholic Star Herald, you will have seen a number of stories one after another because you sort of created a unique series about the winter shelter down here. But Bishop Sullivan was down here, and he was very impressed with it. He'd been here before, but he was even more impressed after his last visit. And he came back and was like, "Mike, you need to do a lot more coverage of that place." And I went, "You're the publisher. You got it. No problem." So then we did something that never happens last week. And to our readers, I apologize to you. I wrote a story, which never happens. I can't remember. I literally cannot remember the last time I wrote a story in the newspaper. I'm not sure I've written one in your tenure.
You have. They're not the fun spiritual ones.
Yeah, no, I get to do all the...
the heavy lifting.
Yeah, I get to do all the bad news ones.
Right. Well, no, not all bad news. But that was a great story.
It was.
Michael Walsh can write an amazing spiritual story.
I think I might have actually used flowery language.
You did?
And it was, although I can't take any of the credit for it because I just used the quotes that that my wonderful interviewees gave to me. And to our listeners, now you get to hear from them directly. So, yes, we are, in fact, down in Atlantic City with the CFR sisters. And with us today is Sister Ann Cattery. How are you doing, Sister?
I'm well, thank you. Good to be with you all.
Thank you for being here. And Sister Joseph?
Yes, wonderful.
Thank you for coming down.
No, we're happy. You're also, which is nice, you've the community's been here since, been in Atlantic City since 2017. And you two are two of the veterans who were here during that first group, as I recall, the two who remain, as a mm-hmm. matter of fact.
That's right.
So, although we have a bunch of lovely sisters who have come down as well, and we always love seeing everybody. Mm-hmm. And in addition to the sisters, you have women coming down to discern with you from time to time, and that group is called?
The St. Michael Missionaries.
The St. Michael Missionaries. Mm-hmm. And we always love to see them. As a matter of fact, they're very easy to recognize whenever they come to the event, because they're very, very modest. Number one, modestly dressed. Number two, number two, modestly dressed. Number one, they are the most smiling young women that I've ever mm-hmm. seen in my entire life. Every time they walk in, it's like, oh, they must be with the CFR sisters.
Yep. They're so happy.
Yes. I could use a little bit of that. But as we mentioned earlier, we're down here specifically because of your winter shelter, which opened in 2021, January 2021.
Yes, January 6, 2021.
Okay. But it was sort of a unique start. This is not something that your community was necessarily known for, certainly not in our neck of the woods. I know you've worked with that community, those in need, as part of it, but actually operating a citywide shelter is a bit new for you guys. So how did that all come to pass, Sister Aunt Gattery?
Yeah. First to say, I mean, we've always desired to have a shelter. Even while we were serving up in New York, our friars have run homeless shelters, and so there's a history of desire for it. But it came about here because of COVID. There became a need. There already is a citywide shelter, the Atlantic City Rescue Mission here, and yet during COVID. There was a concern as the winter months approached that on the very cold days, the nights when the temperature would drop below 32, the mission would normally just kind of open their doors wider to let more people in. But during COVID, with all the social distancing and the spacing, there just wasn't going to be enough space to do that year. And so social workers started to foresee that this was going to be a problem come the winter months of late 2020 and into early 2021. Not just here, but around the state, probably around the country, this was becoming a concern for social workers. And so we were actually in a meeting here early November of 2020, here in Carumba Hall, which is the parish hall of the parish of St. Monica. It's right behind our convent at St. Michael's, for a meeting with some social workers, with our pastor, Father Mohan, some of the local police, really to talk about the issue of homelessness and how to be helping certain individuals that we all are encountering. And it was there that the suggestion was made that more space was going to be needed, that even that this particular hall, which was going unused during those months of the COVID pandemic, would make a good space for it. And we heard that, we just kind of smiled and didn't really respond, because not really sure what that would entail. But after that meeting, it really sat with me and on my heart. Really, we'd been asking the Lord, what more can we be doing to help our neighbors, especially during the pandemic? And this kind of seemed to be an invitation from the Lord to look into it as a possibility. And so we started to ask the questions, at first asking Father Mohan if he would be open to it. And he was. He just knew he himself couldn't take on running a homeless shelter, but we already had such a wide base of benefactors and volunteers who were helping us already with our other ministry at the Father Benedict House. So we had a sense that we would have the support that we would need to start to maybe make this step. And doors just kind of kept opening, getting Father Mohan's permission, going to the diocese, asking them and their lawyers advice on whether opening a homeless shelter would be permissible. But what really made it workable that first year was that the governor had issued an executive order that really waived all of the necessary paperwork that would usually go into establishing a homeless shelter. Foreseeing the need that more spaces were going to be available, were going to be necessary, the paperwork was kind of waived. And so that really made It took us a while to figure out, again, how does one open a shelter? Who do you ask permission of this? But as we started looking into it, and particularly finding out that there was a real path forward that first year, made it possible.
Yeah.
I don't know. Did we tell the listeners that we are in the Code Blue shelter today?
I didn't mention it earlier.
Right.
But that's right. We are actually recording in the, although it's no longer a Code Blue shelter.
Right.
It's now a winter shelter. But that first year, it was a cold,
right.
Code Blue shelter.
Exactly. Exactly. Good distinction.
Yeah.
What is that distinction for those who don't know?
Yes. So on that first year, we only operated on days, on evenings that the county would have called a Code Blue, which would be the temperature was dropping below 32. And that, it's a designation that means that certain resources are available that night, really with the hope of getting everybody off the streets, because it would be life threatening to be out. So we were only open that first year on Code Blue nights that fell between Wednesday and Saturday. We realized that we couldn't make ourselves available every night, but we organized ourselves and this team of volunteers so that each Wednesday through Saturday of that year, we began in January through mid-March, mm-hmm. we'd have a team ready to go should Code Blue be called. And then when it was called, we went into action and people showed up and we would open the shelter overnight. Mm-hmm. Now, that was stressful, though, for us,
boy, yes.
for our volunteers, for the cooks especially, you know, trying to cook a meal for 32 people at last minute. And for the poor, you know, for the poor who don't know whether the county's called it or not necessarily. And again, for the poor, I mean, what's the difference in some ways between 32 degrees and 33 degrees?
True.
So after that first year, we realized, you know what, we'll just call this a winter shelter, and the four nights a week that we're able to be open at that point too, I think we switched to Monday through Thursday nights as better nights, and then we just be open mid-December through mid-March. We're a winter emergency shelter, open every Monday through Thursday night. The poor know that. Our volunteers know that. We know that. We're just much more ready,
yeah.
to accommodate.
And with that change, did it ever result in less beds? Have there been nights when you were not full up, or have you been full up most nights?
There's been a fluke or two, but we've had one or two open beds. But definitely this whole season, we've been full every night.
Every night.
And how many beds are in here, Sister Joseph?
32 beds.
32. So for those who, you know, who haven't seen some of the Catholic Star Herald coverage, I'm just going to explain. So we're in the big hall. There's cots set up. Next to each cot is like a small table and a chair and a pillow. There's some games here, I noticed. So it seems like a place of camaraderie as well as a food and a bed for the night.
Yeah, it's very much about relationships and just getting to know them. There's something really beautiful that happens when people spend the night. There's a level of trust that develops, and I think they appreciate so much being here that the first night they're kind of like tied up. They keep their shoes on. They go to bed with their shoes on because that's what they have to do everywhere else. But come the second night, the shoes come off. You can smell it. but there's also something that they relax and they're able to open up a little bit more and have more conversations. And that's where we found ourselves really in a beautiful place that really matches our charism, our consecration, that we can be like real mothers to them in that place and encourage them to take the right next steps.
You know, that was something that was brought up in the article that I didn't think I touched on enough, was the charisms of the community. We've had you on the podcast before, and we've certainly written a lot about you, but for those who may not be aware of who the CFRs are, what are the charisms of the community? Where are you from, and you know, what do you want to accomplish?
Yeah, so our community was founded in the late 80s in the Bronx, New York, as a parallel community to the CFR Friars. So the Franciscans of the Renewal Friars were originally 8 Capuchin friars. So Capuchins are another branch of Franciscans. And 8 Capuchin friars started a renewal community to really kind of go back to Francis's original ideal, his way of life, of really living among and serving the poor. So themselves living a more austere and radical poverty, but really being available to live among and serve the poor, and particularly for the Capuchins, for our friars as they began the renewal, not to be parish priests, not to administer parishes, but really be with that hands-on work with the poor. And so that was in 1987, and a year later, a group of six lay women felt called to begin a parallel community to the friars, and to live in a similar way and to serve the poor in a similar manner. So our community has grown from those beginnings there in the Bronx. That's still where our community is based up there. So Sister Joseph and I both entered at the same time in 2005, and entered there and did our formation there and lived in our convents there. But we have a missionary desire too, to go where we are sent and where we're invited, again, to live among and to serve the poor. And so our community knew Bishop Sullivan very well from his time as an auxiliary bishop in the Bronx, in New York. And I think he had a high respect for our life and our work there, particularly our work among the poor. Mm-hmm. So it was really at his invitation, his initiative, to when he became the bishop down here in Camden, to have us come and serve with him. And I think it was in 2015 when the parishes here were being merged and there were extra buildings now available, that he really again re-invited and invited Mother Lucille and the others on the council to come down and to see Atlantic City and to see the buildings that he had available. And Mother Lucille speaks about walking the boardwalk and seeing the poverty and finding out that people live actually under the boardwalk, and her heart was moved, and she just knew that this would be a place for us to come and to serve and to live out that call, mm-hmm. To be among the poor and to serve the poor, that this would be a good fit for us, and the bishop was right and she was right, for sure, that this has been because Atlantic City has a lot of complexity, poverty here that is somewhat inherent because of the casinos and the brokenness that attracts and perpetuates, that there's always a lot of work to be done here.
You know, about not this past summer, but the summer before, when the beginning of the National Eucharistic Congress started and we had the kickoff here with the large procession down the boardwalk, one of the memories that will always stick out to me is how all of your sisters were on the boardwalk as well, walking and interacting with those that were maybe just popping out of the bodegas and to see what was going on. But a lot of them knew you. Mm. Like, you could see that familiarity in the community. Like, they knew you because you walk among them. You're part of that community. And that came across so obvious to me. I absolutely loved witnessing that. Mm.
Yeah, and that brings up, you know, another, here we've talked about our charism being that that hands-on work with the poor. The other part of it is the evangelization, to be ready and available at all times to witness to the love of God for us, for his people, for his church. And yeah, so that we'll never forget that Eucharistic procession. That was a really grace-filled moment, first and foremost, to give glory to God and his Eucharistic presence, and the great gift to have him among us, and then to be able to bring him to the people that we serve, the people that we love, many of the poor who spend their, so that was a warm summer night, spend their summer nights out there on the boardwalk. So that was a great gift.
Just one other thing about your community, which I've often been impressed by, is that there are communities that are 100% dedicated to service, and there are communities that are 100% dedicated to prayer. And your community seems to split the difference pretty evenly. That you're certainly, every religious community has a healthy prayer life, but yours is. I remember thinking the first time we interviewed you was quite specific. You know, you have times for prayer, and you have times for spiritual interests, and then you have time for service. How do you sort of, you know, manage that time, particularly now that you've had the shelter added to your work?
Yeah, that's definitely always a challenge, like a tension. But we almost consider that healthy and right. I think the day we lose the tension between those two, we've gone overboard in one direction or the other. So there's this need to prioritize our prayers. We couldn't do the shelter if we weren't really, really rooted in our life of prayer. And we wouldn't have this attunement to the Holy Spirit to be really present to each one of our guests if we're not in the chapel during the day as well. But then if we are only in the chapel and we're not living our charism by being with the poor, then something is out of whack too, because this is what we were made for. So these two, they really need to go together, so that when we're among the poor, we also recognize the same Jesus we adored in the Blessed Sacrament, in our chapel, in the poor that we serve. So it's a tension, and there's always like the doorbell rings during prayers and like, I don't want to go. But when do you go, and when do you put a boundary? So that's a tension that always needs to be worked out. But I think it's exactly in that tension, because our love is in both directions, that Jesus can be really present.
This makes me feel better about my own difficulties with finding time for prayer, and that, you know, that's a nice little reminder. Mm-hmm. Thank you, sister. I appreciate that. Mm-hmm. To get back to the shelter specifically, we talked about how it started as a Code Blue, and then for the sanity of everybody, converted to a winter shelter the next year. What does a day in the life of the shelter look like, Sister Joseph? When do you get fired up now that you know what your schedule is?
Yes, so every day from 1 to 3, there's a group of volunteers that show up here, and they clean the shelter, they make the beds, they prepare the kitchen, and they get the shelter ready for the night. And usually sometime between 3 and 4, the cooks show up, and they come and they bring all the food, and they prepare it here in the kitchen and get everything ready. So that all happens. We have our holy hour from 4 to 5. So usually we don't, a lot of is happening here and we're not even here.
That's good management.
But then at 6 o'clock we come here, and the intake volunteers are here. Usually like 6 to 8 people come to serve with us to do the intake. We get organized, we say a prayer together, and then we open the doors at 6:30, and the guests come in. They go through a little intake process. We take down their names, do a little security check. They can put their anything that they don't need for the night in the bins, and it'll be securely stored for them through the night. And then they can find a bed and get their food. Usually at 7:30, there's an invitation to go pray the rosary. So a group of our guests and a group of volunteers will go over to St. Michael's Church to pray the rosary there. And oftentimes there are already volunteers in the church interceding for the shelter at the same time. And then at 8 o'clock, our overnight volunteers show up. They are the real heroes. We definitely could not have the shelter without our overnight volunteers, who stay up the whole night. And they just make sure that everything remains peaceful. And if any of the guests have needs or questions, or they can deal with that. And then at 5:30, we come back over in the morning to conduct discharge, so wake everybody up, give them breakfast, make sure they're on their way for the day. And at 6:45, everybody needs to be out. And usually there's a little procession of some of our guests to the local parish church here for the 7 o'clock morning mass.
Oh, that's nice.
That they join us there. So. Yep.
That's excellent.
That's so sweet. I love that.
And you've done, talking a little bit about your volunteers. Your volunteers seem to have come out in droves. Certainly, you've had a volunteer database with the Father Benedict House, which I want to go back to and talk to it before we finish this podcast. But this entity seems to have really attracted a lot of volunteers who are very supportive. How many volunteers do you have in your database?
Oh, the database? Oh, like maybe like 150 or something.
Wow.
Or closer to 200 maybe at this point. Yeah, it's a very...
Very robust.
It's a robust. Yes, and I think people love to serve, mm-hmm. and it's just a beautiful opportunity for people to actually hands-on work with the poor. It can be so intimidating or so difficult, but this is a format that anybody can plug into in anywhere where it fits. Like, some people cannot drive at night, or they don't want to be directly hands-on with the poor, but they can make the beds. Mm-hmm. They do want to serve and help out. Mm-hmm. And so serving the poor is an integral part of our Catholic life. Mm-hmm. And so just to give people that opportunity, they really appreciate it. And then also we get people who are not Catholic. That just serving the poor is very attractive to many people, and a great way to grow deeper in their faith, in their relationship with God. And this is where they ask us all of our questions. And this is where I find that our charism of evangelization is very real, mm-hmm. That we have a lot of beautiful conversations. We see people, when they come and serve, grow in their faith.
Oh, yeah.
You know, if I can interject, I really wanted to credit the diocese and your all's support of us and promotion of our ministries, because really it was during COVID when everybody else was kind of closing down and we still had the Father Benedict House mm-hmm. up and running, that the word went out, I think through the Star Herald and through your all's social media pages and through different emails. Donna Octaviano sent out emails on our behalf that we needed supplies to help us keep the Father Benedict House going, our ministry there, which it was usually to bring people inside and serve them a breakfast meal, became an outdoor meal handout, and we wanted to send people home with extra food supplies. So the word went out that we needed help, that we needed supplies, and the diocese responded. I think of a number of parish contacts mm-hmm. that started during that COVID period that have continued now into the shelter, that really began at that summer of 2020, mm-hmm. When people were really looking for how to help and didn't know how, but we were open and we let people know that we needed more support, and they really came through really generously. So between that and really our presence at the convocation, the Joy of the Gospel Convocation mm-hmm. back in 2018, I think that really helped put us on the map for a number of the diocesan parish groups. So, yeah, you all have been a big part in building our volunteer database. So.
Well, the community here has made our jobs a lot easier, because the work you're doing in the community is what brings everybody here. Mm-hmm. We're happy to be a vessel, but yeah. It's all in support of you. Although, you know, since we brought it up now three or four times, I do want to talk about Father Benedict House, just so our listeners don't have to. I don't want to force them to make have to listen to all 55 minutes. Mm-hmm. What is the Father Benedict House?
Yeah, so the Father Benedict House is a drop-in center for the poor. It's in the old convent on the St. Nicholas campus, so that's over on Pacific Avenue, so right across the street from a lot of the big casinos, and really in the roughest part, I think, of Atlantic City, the highest hard drug use over there, drug use, drug dealing, lots of prostitution. A lot of boarding houses are there, so very low income individuals who are really only able to rent a room are there, so very food unstable, a lot of food instability. So a simple breakfast program on Tuesday and Thursday mornings. We open the doors of the Father Benedict House, the first floor of that old convent, from 10 to 11:30 for people to come and sit in our dining room and have a simple breakfast. It's bagels, donuts, bananas, coffee, but more than that, it's a ministry of presence. It's a place where they feel safe, they feel welcomed. We have like a front recreation room, play chess or checkers, or there's a guitar and a piano, and often
they get used.
Yeah, they get used. Wow. Yeah, I guess pick them up and play a little jam sessions there. Our chapel with our Eucharistic Lord is there, and people can come in and pray or light a candle. Many people who might not be accustomed or comfortable praying, there is something really beautiful about lighting a candle and making that your prayer, and just being with us, visiting with us. So,
yeah. And you know, I asked you as part of the article, was there much crossover between the guests of the Father Benedict House and the guests here. And Sister Joseph, you said that not as much as you might think.
Yes, there definitely is a crossover. There's a good number of people that we know from the Father Benedict House that are coming here now. I think what Sister was saying about the hub there by the Father Benedict House, the people who are there in the boarding rooms or the really heavy drug users, that doesn't really make their way over here. I think a lot of them would know that they wouldn't make it through the night without taking more drugs, and that is obviously not permitted here. And then also for some people, the divide in the city, they wouldn't cross out of their little regions. But for the most part, we know most of our people that come to the shelter also from the Father Benedict House. Or once they've started coming to the shelter, now they're going to the Father Benedict House. Mm-hmm. So,
do you see a lot of the same faces here at the shelter?
Yes. The way the shelter is set up now is that when they stay the night, they get a ticket to come back the next night. That gives them a little bit of stability, nice. Knowing where they are going to sleep that night. Mm-hmm. And that really helps them free them up to do something productive with their day without having to wonder where they are going to sleep that night. So we found that that's really stabilizing for them and helpful. And so, but that doesn't mean that most of our nights, the majority of the people are regulars, are people who have been before.
Yeah. And I think I may not have asked this question earlier. How long is from what day to what day is the winter? Winter shelter open from December to March?
Mid December to mid March. So we opened, I think it was December 11th this year, and this March 14th will be our last night.
Okay. Excellent. So you know you've now been shelter operators for 4 years, roughly. And is this something that you feel that you've now become quite adept at, or do you feel like you're still learning?
Yeah, we're always learning, for sure. I do think that we have a good model down, a good system. I was just reflecting on the developments of each year. Each year there's a refinement to the process and, getting more streamlined. And what Sister was just mentioning about the tickets, you know, the first 2 years we didn't have tickets. The first 2 years we were first come, first serve every night, which again was stressful for the poor, stressful for us. Very, very difficult when you have 45 people hoping to get into 32 beds and you have to turn them away. And how do you make distinctions? And so this ticket system, which we instituted last year, people can receive tickets and stay for 3 weeks, which for us is 12 nights since we're 4 nights a week. If they hope to stay beyond those 3 weeks, they have to have filled out what we call an action plan. They have to have taken a paper form that we have, brought it to a city social worker who would review it with them and articulate on the form what their action plan is to resolve their homelessness, what their next steps are. The social worker needs to return it to us. And so only if somebody is willing to be working with a social worker and, again, actively working to resolve their homelessness, can they stay beyond those 3 weeks. So that was something that we began last year, which we saw to be very, very fruitful, very, motivating,
motivating.
For people to take the next step. And sometimes that's what people needed was simply that. A deadline and a motivation and the desire to keep on staying here and to start really working on things. So we found that to be very effective.
Very fruitful, yes. And realistically, to get your paperwork back in order, if you've lost everything, like your ID, that takes more than 3 weeks. Like, actually, it can really take months.
Yeah.
And then the housing situation, it is really hard to find any kind of affordable housing around here, so...
So it sounds like you work with the local community, like you're talking about working with social workers and caseworkers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we really see ourselves more like a bridge towards the social workers. We don't do direct social work ourselves. But yeah, that constant encouraging and showing the way for a lot of our guests, really just where do you start? What do you do? Mm-hmm. So the yellow action plan form is like, okay, this is what you do. You take this form and you go to a social worker and you ask them to fill it out, but then at least they know they have a relationship with a social worker to help them through the process.
But it sounds like there's also a lot of personal responsibility, you know, and not everybody's, you know, doing it for them. It's mm-hmm. like, okay, you're giving them, helping them with the dignity to take the steps themselves to
exactly.
be a, you know, a decider in their own lives.
Exactly. Yeah, they have to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Have you had many success stories since you've opened? Have there been good? I know I reported on a couple of them, so I know there have been. But you know, I have to imagine those successes can maybe help you move, help you stay positive during those tough weeks.
Yes, because sometimes it can look very difficult, and it can take people so long to get on their feet. But at the end of last year, I did a little putting some data together. And just to notice from that 60% of the people who stayed at the shelter last year had found either housing or had gone into long-term programs. Mm. So this 60% of the people who slept more than 5 nights at our shelter last year landed on their feet. So that was really encouraging.
I think that's a success.
That pie chart is...
That gives me chills. Like, I actually just got chills.
Yeah, it can look so hopeless, and it can look so difficult, and... yeah, but at the end of the year, and we didn't do it, they did it for themselves, and they went through the process, and it was a long process. But I do believe that just the encouragement, the accompaniment, being known, and just every day being encouraged to go do something positive mm-hmm. did contribute to their success. So.
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, it's always hard to take that first step, mm-hmm. right? So the fact that somebody would even come to the door here, to me, is a step of bravery to say, I need some place to stay, and while I'm here, maybe I can get some help. So, you
exactly.
know, I love
yeah.
that and the dignity of that.
And, you know, something that was brought, I keep referencing the article because you had so many great quotes in it.
Is it because you wrote it? Or you just keep.
What do you want? It was a great article. I'm really good at my job. Actually, it wasn't a great article, but I hope people got something out of it.
Good editor too. Good editor.
Well, the editor definitely fixed a lot of things. The one thing that you mentioned, both of you, in the conversation I had with you was your charism of mothering. And, you know, it caught my attention every time I wrote it down. You know, do you get the opportunity to mother often?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, this life is a life of spiritual motherhood to the fullest. It looks different than physical mothering. It's not holding a small child in my arms. But many opportunities with the poor, with the sisters, with the missionaries, in a particular way for me as their director, but no, with the poor, very very beautifully. And yeah, I think what we were sharing before was that the recognition of sisters saying we're not social workers, we're not trying to be social workers, but more than a warm place and a safe place to sleep, these people need the encouragement of a mother to take the next good step. If somebody doesn't feel that their life is worth anything, that anybody cares, why try to take that step? Why try to jump through that hoop of that paperwork? And but we can be here at night asking them how their day was, asking them what their plan is, and then in the morning we're here as we send them off. Okay, now go, you know, speak with so-and-so today, follow up with that appointment, go to the clinic, get that little infection checked out, you know, as a mother would encourage. And then they come back, and how'd that go? And that accountability, mm-hmm. that encouragement in the morning, that accountability in the evening. That's the role of a mother, and that's what all of us need, really, in order to do the hard things in life, the things that are good for us, but the hard things in life, to be encouraged and accountable, and know that somebody cares. And so, yeah, that we're able to do that. Mm-hmm. So there's that, you know, the encouragement, the talking, and then there's many beautiful moments. I'm thinking of last Thursday night. I was here, and really one of the most broken women I've ever met came in late, and we made an exception because she was trying to sleep in our recycling bin. We found her trying to sleep in our recycling bin, and I just thought I couldn't leave her there. I needed to bring her inside. And She was very quickly ready to go to sleep, but I knelt down by her cot to say a prayer with her. But she was rubbing her foot, and her feet were blistered and sore, and there was an open blister, and you know, she asked if we had anything to a Band-Aid or anything. So I went and got some Neosporin and a Band-Aid, and just that moment of kneeling by her cot, helping her put this Neosporin and this Band-Aid around her foot, and she looked up at me. She said, "Thanks, Mom."
Let's talk about spiritual mother.
Yeah, exactly. Which is a clear sign of her. She knows her need for a mother. She knows it, and she's not afraid to express it. So yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Where was that?
Yeah, where was that in the article?
It just happened.
That just happened.
Sister and Kat are receiving you. It just happened, Mike. It's okay.
But that's the beauty of. So we've talked about this on the podcast before. I've worked in homeless shelters as a PR person, not as a social worker, for most of my career over the last 25 years. And it's stories like that that make it very easy to do my job, which is a very easy job to begin with. But, you know, it's stories like that that I know that will resonate with people. As a matter of fact, I was sitting across, I'm sitting across from Jen right now as you were telling that story, and I could see her clutching her pearls and being so moved by it. And it's the things, I have to imagine that stories like that that resonate with your volunteers as well and your donors, that, you know, the really good work that the sisters do, not just here, but all over Atlantic City, all in and New York City and Ireland, as a matter of fact.
I'm sure.
You know, the work of the CFRs has been truly exemplary. So we're very happy that you're here. Mm-hmm. Something you mentioned, speaking about the sisters in general, was I asked you about the future of the shelter and its expansion. Had you thought about things? And you mentioned that the city and the county have come to you multiple times about the possibility of extending this, you know, as a full year shelter. And your response to me, Strand Cattery, was not that you needed more money, though you would certainly need more money. You would need more sisters.
Right.
Could you describe, like, you know, not that it's a burden on you, but I have to imagine that it is a great deal of time and personal expense.
Well, also because you have other ministries. There's a lot of other work you're doing.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, this isn't our only ministry. But yeah, when we told the county that in order to do this more, we would need more sisters, it's while we recognize that the volunteers are a huge part of who we are and what we do, and we need volunteers to partner with us and assist us. It is the sisters. It's that spiritual motherhood that sets the tone and that really makes the shelter what it is. The five of us, and we're about to go down to four sisters here. About to lose one of our sisters to Ireland. She's moving to Ireland. We're happy for them. but we, we're limited. We're limited. We just simply can't be here every night doing this because of our other ministries and our human limitations. So if we were to keep this open and keep it open longer, we would need more sisters. Again, not that the sisters are doing everything. We don't try to do everything. But we always try to have a sister present because it's a spiritual motherhood, the power of our consecration, that I think is the secret ingredient here. Yeah, exactly.
I would agree with that. And you had mentioned that you felt that this is a very repeatable program, but that's the one element that isn't necessarily repeatable. And that's not to say that other shelters don't do wonderful work, right, and wouldn't bandage a foot or take care of people or bring someone in. But there is that certain undefinable quality that you have shown since 2017 in every ministry that you've been a part of. And I have to say, you know, certainly Father Benedict House and the winter shelter here at St. Michael's is great work. But there are you two pop up all over the place. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, Jen was just commenting and complimenting the two of you that that the sisters were in Seton Hall the other day. What was the background to that trip?
Yeah, so our youth group has really expanded here. I think since 2018, maybe not the first year, we've tried to host a little high school age youth group here at St. Michael's for the parish of St. Monica and anyone else who wants to join us. For many years, we were only able to meet once a month, which is not really ideal for high school youth ministry. I know those relationships are mm-hmm. are so need the weekly accountability and weekly friendships to really deepen. So this year, we were able to move to that weekly format again because we had five sisters now for the first time for a full year. So we were able to move to the weekly format, and so we've just really seen it take off. And the weekly format and the fact that we now have a dedicated youth room in the space above St. Michael's Church has really helped. I also credit Sister Guadalupe, our first Hispanic American sister, being here in our ranks, and her ability to most of the youth group is the Hispanic teenagers, and we've had Hispanic teenagers coming since we began, but she's able to connect with the parents, which it goes a long way in terms of strengthening those relationships. So this growing high school youth group on Thursday nights, 7 to 8:30, we call it Heart to Heart. 24 kids. Yeah,
That's a really good turnout.
Really good. I mean, we've already outgrown the space that we're in, and we've seen over the past year or two how fruitful it is to take them on trips, the bonding, the experience of getting out of Atlantic City. Their relationships with us, the relationships with each other, just really go much deeper when you take a road trip together. And so we found other different events, and the sisters were looking for something to do this spring, and we were considering different retreats that were like 4 or 5 hours away. And I just said, you know what? We have these. It was really after seeing the seminarians. Oh, we always see them at the Wedding of the Sea and at different places where we run into the seminarians, and hearing that they have just a good group of them right now at Seton Hall, the idea came to us like, let's just get the boys, and because we have a number of teenage boys who have expressed openness to the priesthood, we're like, well, okay, let's be the matchmakers here, and nice. Get the boys to go up and spend a day at St. Andrew's Hall, the residence of the minor seminary, the college seminary, there at Seton Hall. So our seminarian Theo was our main contact there. He helped to organize it, and of course Father Nevitt, we let him know about it, and he jumped on board, and really he was the host, really. He really facilitated the day once we got up there. Mm-hmm. Sisters worked hard. Sister Guadalupe in particular worked hard getting, so many permission forms needed to take people on a trip. But we got eight teenage boys to meet here. Sister Filomena, Sister Guadalupe, Father Mohan all drove cars up to the seminary. And they had a wonderful day. The seminarians did a wonderful job of hosting them. They had mass for some of the boys. It was the first time ever being in like a private mass. They've been to parish masses, a mass that was organized just for them, that they were the main honored guests, and it was just there in the chapel of the St. Andrew Hall. That really impressed them, and then having pizza with the seminaries, and then even though it was a freezing cold day, in fact we weren't sure if the trip was going to happen because it had snowed. They all went outside and played sports for an hour and a half.
Oh, wow.
And the sisters finally had to,
It's youth.
Yeah, exactly.
Boys, I don't know.
Yeah, God bless them. And those seminarians are young and healthy. They were out there playing, and then they came inside and had a Q&A. And supposedly that went really well. The boys asked some great questions. the seminarians I heard gave great responses. And that was it. They headed back here. They all said they would do it again. They all would love to go back. Mm-hmm. So it was really, you know, I know everybody prays for vocations. I mean, this was just a really practical way to promote them.
Agreed. And that sounds great. Matter of fact, that now I'm a little annoyed, to be honest with you, because I keep asking Father Nevitt and Father Chahesky to invite me up to the seminary, and it hasn't happened yet. So now I'm going to say, well, this youth group got to go up. Come on, guys.
You need to ask the sisters. They will take
you know what? That's exactly, that is the key. So the youth group, that story was fantastic. We were so happy to be able to put that in the newspaper as well. The other thing that the sisters do is the first Saturday devotionals, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And that... what does that usually entail?
So, of course, Our Lady of Fatima asked for the first Saturday of the month in particular for special devotions to be prayed in reparation for all of the offenses against her Immaculate Heart. And she specifically asked for 5 consecutive first Saturdays for people to offer these devotions, very simply that they would receive Holy Communion, go to confession, pray the rosary, keep her company for 15 minutes, so kind of 15 minutes of meditating on the rosary, all with the purpose of reparation to her. So since we moved here in summer of 2017, and that first February of 2018, we started offering here at St. Michael's for people to come together and do that. You don't have to do it with a group. You could do it in your own home, of course. Going to confession and receiving mass and going and receiving Holy Communion requires going to church, but the other things can be done on your own, which we highly encourage people. But we realize for ourselves and for many of our friends and benefactors to come together and to pray those devotions is very beautiful, very powerful. So from February to June, on the first Saturday of the month, we gather here at St. Michael's from 10 to 1 to offer the opportunity for those devotions and, you know, the opportunity for confession. Last month in February was our first month kicking it off for this year, and I think we probably had about 130 people, and I think all 130 tried to go to confession. We had 7 confessors going for about 2 hours. So we hope to be better prepared this month with more and ready this first Saturday in March. But we found it to be, just a beautiful way of honoring Our Lady, but also a beautiful opportunity to gather with all of these volunteers, with these benefactors, and to kind of be help spiritually recharge them. Many of them find it to be a retreat day, where it's been a gift. You know, our CFR friars based up in New York and most especially the friars in Newark, New Jersey, have really supported us, and so usually we're able to have one of them come down. Not that diocesan priests can't do this as well, but our friars are usually great preachers, great confessors, have a gift for that, and so that's been one of the draws for people to come and be able to benefit from their presence. The music and the prayer, and then we have a particular style of praying with people, again, to bring people into an encounter with our Eucharistic Lord through Eucharistic adoration, and so our Lord is exposed on the altar throughout the devotions. But then we end with something we call a Eucharistic healing procession, where people are invited to come up and kneel in the first pew, and the priest will bring Our Lord and the monstrance to each person individually, which is just a very powerful moment of encounter with our Eucharistic Lord that people don't often have the opportunity for. And yeah, our Lord heals, our Lord consoles in those moments of encounter. So a beautiful day.
So Jen and I were working on the headline to the story, and on the shelter, and she goes, and I had put charisms in this thing, and she goes, is it charism or charisms? And I go, no, it's charisms. It's definitely plural there. It's multiple charisms in this community. And that is a fine example. This entire podcast is a fine example of the work of the CFRs, your dedication to service and the poor and the needy, but your dedication to the spiritual well-being of everybody as well. So, you know, Bishop Sullivan deserves a medal for having brought you all down here, and then you deserve a tonnage of medals for all of the great work that you've actually done, not just in the community of Atlantic City, but throughout South Jersey. And that is because we see you pop up every place, and you know, it's when we see the gray habit and the black veils appear, we're like, okay, the sisters are here, everything will be fine. So, and that's not to say anything against any of the other religious communities, but you have developed a well-earned reputation, and we want to thank you for your great work in South Jersey and for letting us come down and chat with you. So thank you for that as well.
Thank you.
All right. And Jen, thank you for making the trip down here as well. And to our listeners, thank you for all for checking us in with us, and we'll catch you all next week. See you, everybody.